your hand if in that last song you were a part of that hallelujah chorus. Wow. What a great counterpoint that was. There's been several times as we've been involved in our worship and going through a particular song, and I'll hear that underlying chorus, each of you, and have always just enjoyed the talent, of course, that's there. We, each of us, have our individual roles to play, and varying widely, but never better seen this idea of Paul twice, in fact, in the Roman and 1 Corinthians letter, dealing with the body and how we each have, you know, a part and none more important than another, all of equal value, but each, you know, with unique roles to play as well. So I appreciate each and every soul that's here. We're joined together in a common faith and in the hope that all that we do as we express in worship, in prayer, in song, in personal Bible study, in the way that we lead our lives, that arm or hand or finger or toenail that each of us is. May we just be devoted to becoming as Christ-like as we possibly can be. We have been involved now in what is a five-part series with very differing lengths on the five discourses of Matthew. If you haven't been with us, it's very apparent that Matthew was led by the Holy Spirit to record five different occasions where Jesus speaks at length. Now, three of these are a single chapter. Two of them, however, have three chapters devoted to them. And so both the Sermon on the Mount and now chapters 23, 24, and 25 are massive. Now, particularly with the Sermon on the Mount, there's a wide-ranging subject matter, and we spent an enormous amount of time on the Sermon on the Mount. With Matthew chapters 23 and 24 and 25, and particularly with 23 and 25, we'll be able to go very much more quickly. So we're not going to spend a lot of time in those chapters, but please do be opening to Matthew chapter 23. And then we'll not be spending really much time either in chapter 24. We've had occasion here for a variety of reasons to see intersections with Matthew 24 in the Old Testament and in the book of Revelation, which I've also taught here a few years back. And so if you're visiting with us, I always apologize for those that don't have the background. It'll particularly hurt as we get into this last section of these five discourses, as I'm going to lean rather heavily on past material, and so we'll pass rather quickly through 23, 24, and 25. I selected as a title photo here this evening what is a model of the Temple Mount that is outside the... I was supposed to go differently, did it not? I got a different slide here. I was hoping to take away this band and that band, but apparently failed to get it done. What you can't see just out of sight are the bellies and necks, the number of people standing in the back there. Forget the actual scale model size, but it's huge. Covers an enormous area outside of the Israel Museum and immediately adjacent to the temple of the scroll, shrine of the scroll there. And so these two are the most dramatic displays at the Israel Museum. But I want you to see this today because the location of Jesus, I think, has a lot of bearing on 23, 24, and 25. I'm not going to go through the other passages in Mark and Luke that record this event. And Matthew doesn't tell us this part that we learn elsewhere. But as you look at the temple right here, this is the court of the women. And it's a huge area. It is the only area, though, that the women were allowed to pass into within the temple enclosure itself. The priests would mount these stairs here to the gate of Nicanor, and they were allowed into what is a surprisingly large area that looks very narrow right here, but there's a court of the priests back there. And then finally you come to the doors that lead into the temple itself. So you can see it's a massive structure. This particular model doesn't have any people to give you size, but you can see the stairs here. You can see the stairs here. Standard steps about 7 inches. And so it's just huge, massive thing. It's believed, thanks to Josephus' very careful descriptions of this temple, which, of course, he saw and was a Pharisee and was able to work within, that we have four areas inside there that are dedicated to particular functions of the priests.
But you have these colonnades that are on either side. Can't see this one, but you got this one right here. And there were boxes
shaped like trumpets that you would put your gifts into, that you would put your alms into. So this was the temple treasury collection area. And it's very apparent from the other Gospels that what we're about to study in the 23rd chapter, and I hope to cover the whole chapter this morning, is taking place right there. Jesus has just observed the widow with her mite. And so he will teach on that in Mark's Gospel. But what follows in Matthew 23 then is taking place here. And we'll be told that in leaving the temple, he'll go to the Mount of Olives, which then looks right down onto this this front side of the temple itself. But try to imagine yourself down here in this huge area, throngs of people coming, male and female, to offer their votive gifts. Jesus sees what is taking place there. He also sees the terrible corruption that's going on there, the greed and the cruelty of the men that were the money changers, of those that you know were collecting much of this for their own personal profit, using it incorrectly for their own personal glory. And so Jesus's mind is first drawn to the circumstances that we're dealing with here because of a widow with a tiny, minuscule little offering that Jesus says is more than all the rest, because she's giving out, you know, of the meager circumstances. All that she had to live on is how he describes it. Now, in order to save some time here, I'm not going to have very many slides. We're just going to go through this as an outline right now. But this location, as I've said, is inside that temple courtyard, as close as most people would be able to get to the temple itself. In the first 12 verses, Jesus just simply says, don't be like these scribes and Pharisees. And then he lists a lot of subpoints on things that they're doing, but do not be like these guys. So if you want to group those verses somehow in your Bible, or if you're making a separate outline, the whole underlayment for this sermon is don't be like those guys. He will then, in a lengthy section, verses 13 through 32, pronounce the 8 woes upon you scribes and Pharisees, hypocrites. Now, Jesus has always been very personal in his denunciations of the religious leaders of his time, and in his very pointed rebukes and reprimands and reprovals of those who are out of line, those who are not living according to the law that they were under. And unless they could do better than these scribes and Pharisees, as we've already studied in a previous lesson, they can't even enter the kingdom of heaven. A theme along those lines will come up in these 8 woes in just a minute. But, you know, here, very publicly, in what would have been in front of quite a number of people, his disciples certainly as well, and there in the temple courtyard, which is going to be the theme for all 3 chapters, Jesus will pronounce these 8 woes to these hypocrites and to their faces, those however many that may have been present at the time. And then in verses 33 through 36, he will discuss the sentence of Gehenna. Since the translation hell is variantly understood and misunderstood, a shame, because the word never should have appeared in a translation. The word there is very familiar, well known to the people of Jerusalem. They're adjacent to it when they're on the temple. It refers to the valley of Hinnom. It's Gehenna. Topheth is another way that it's referred to in the Old Testament as well as in the New. The sentence of Gehenna calls to mind terrible things, frightening things, great warnings, because this is the location where the idol Molech had been set up, and because of the just astonishing defilement that Molech visits upon this region, because they were offering human sacrifice of their own children to this idol in the Old Testament. Then this valley of Hinnom, the sons of Hinnom, the valley of Gehenna in the New Testament, this place is most odious in the hearing, in the eyes, and the thoughts of the Jews. It also, a portion of it, is immediately adjacent to what's called the Dung Gate. The Dung Gate, to this day, is one of the more traversed as it's immediately adjacent again to the temple. So apparently what would have been a lot of filth that is left over after the sacrifice of these animals and in other functions of the temple service was, we're not entirely sure about this, but it looks like that was being taken then out the dung gate and perhaps, maybe even likely, dumped then in the Valley of Gehenna, dumped there in the Valley of Hinnom. It is also apparently the place as well where if the Romans or the Jews themselves had for some reason a particular shame attached to a given criminal or crime, that they would toss these bodies. And so we haven't been able to verify, you know, some of these ideas, but what we pick out of it at least is that this Valley of Gehenna, you know, does not hold good feelings and for the Jews whatsoever. And a pronouncement of a sentence that they cannot escape takes place, as these scribes and Pharisees cannot escape, in verses 33 through 36. Then in 37, 38, and 39, the desolation of Jerusalem, which will be a focal point with the abomination of desolation in Matthew 24, is first mentioned. A location and a time frame is also, of course, assigned to when this is going to take place. So the desolation of Jerusalem then is introduced by Jesus as a result of these men's terrible crimes. So let's have a look now, and sorry about that, I was just going to leave that up till I got to the other one. There's your outline there, so we'll leave that up. As we read then these first 12 verses. In chapter 23 and verse 1, Jesus spoke to the multitudes and to his disciples, saying, "The scribes and the Pharisees." Now you talk about being singled out very publicly. These people are the prominent leaders, the power brokers, and they wield the power even of casting out of the synagogue, which is a banishment from all Jewish social activities. It is a virtual sentence of banishment then from the entire community as well. It would drive you out of your home, of your job. The scribes and the Pharisees, who wield this awesome power so very foully and with such sin and with such corrupt minds and hearts, he says, have seated themselves in the chair of Moses. Well, obviously, that's no compliment. That deals with a seizure, with usurping. What they've done in the position they occupy, they do not occupy by right. They have failed utterly in all that they do, as your religious leaders who wield the utmost power over you. Here's what they do. In verse 3, all they tell you, do and observe, because they were the masters of the Old Testament, but do not do according to their deeds, for they say and do not do. Brother, this is your classic definition of a hypocrite. A play actor is what the word means. Put on a show, put on a front. But it's not real. So they bind all these things on everybody else, and then, of course, they figured out all these different caveats and loopholes where they themselves would not have to keep their own laws. They tie up, for instance, in verse 4, heavy loads, lay them on men's shoulders, but they themselves are unwilling to move them with so much as a finger. But they do all their deeds to be noticed by men. For they broaden their phylacteries, lengthen the tassels of the garments, love the place of honor at banquets and the chief seats in the synagogues, and respectful greetings in the marketplaces, and being called by men rabbi. But do not be called rabbi, for one is your teacher. The word, of course, means teacher. It's translated for us even in Scripture, as it is here. One is your teacher. You're all brothers. Do not call anyone on earth your father, for one is your father who is in heaven. And do not be called leaders, for one is your leader, that is Christ. But the greatest among you shall be your servant, and whoever exalts himself shall be humbled, and whoever humbles himself shall be exalted. So quite a number of examples are given of the shamefulness of these men who are present at all times in this courtyard. And elsewhere hold their very Sanhedrin meetings up there in the Temple Mount, though not in that particular courtyard. So they say and they do not. And whether these loads in verse 4 are physical or they're emotional or they're doctrinal, I don't think is singled out or defined or matters. Everything these men do, they refuse themselves to justly participate in. They do in verse 5 to be noticed. They do to have the places of honor in verse 6. They do for the respectful greetings in verse 7. They do so that they can occupy places as teachers, as fathers, and as leaders among them. So 11 and 12 certainly underscores all that this sermon is built on. It's the first summary statement that Jesus offers right here. And of course, we've just seen this in the start of Matthew 18 only a couple of weeks ago, when the disciples are arguing about who's the greatest. Jesus calls the child, says you need to humble yourself like this child. He's still teaching this. Now bear in mind, some time has passed since Matthew 18. This is now Matthew 23. Jesus has already come with the palm frowns and the shouts, you know, that he is their new king. And so Jesus is now but a day or two away from his crucifixion. And he has then, knowing that his time is short and knowing that he is to do all things in accordance with the Father's will, has apparently been becoming increasingly more demanding, if you will, publicly, and more personal publicly in his excoriations of these people. These people need to be humiliated, they need to be shamed, they need to be identified, you know, in front of everyone for the colossal failure that they have made of their positions due to the arrogance that has fallen upon them. And so, to be avoided, of course, under any and all circumstances. Now, we come then, and I'll go ahead and put up this next outline, to these eight woes. You know, just in the history of mankind, you can hardly imagine any event in which anyone is more directly and pointedly singled out to be humiliated, since they lacked all humility themselves, in front of who knows how many people. These eight woes are very personal. These eight woes are about attitudes and behaviors. These eight woes are indictments. They are attacks upon the characters of these men. Jesus is not pleased, and he is not withholding any of his displeasure. Yes, he is, in fact, the Messiah. After 3.5 years of preaching, working miracles, after all that he has done, vast numbers of people have just been praising him as he entered the kingdom, the city, for proclaiming him to be their king. They're going to turn on him shortly. But his major opponents are these men. And they have misled and have hurt terribly those that would have come to their Messiah. And for this, they must answer now, and as the next two chapters will tell us in the not-too-distant future. So, of these eight woes, the first has a single verse. You have been hindering the kingdom seekers. Woe to you, scribes and Pharisees, hypocrites, because you shut off the kingdom of heaven from men, for you do not enter in yourselves, nor do you allow those who are entering to go in. Close as the kingdom may be, a couple of months off now, still yet they're under Moses' law. Still yet that kingdom exists. Still yet people are in it. Still yet these men wouldn't get in it. Well, they might have. And they're hindering those who are entering in. Not who will be entering in a few months from now in Acts 2, but who are. This has been an ongoing thing since God has had people. God has been the king. And God has had then the rulership over a kingdom and has been appealing to humankind to enter into it. Pharisees were barring the door. You know, brethren, I once visited on a vacation a congregation. I won't even name the state, nowhere near here. But on a vacation and went to visit this congregation and had an individual tell me, it was the only time I was ever there, told me that at the top of those stairs, one of their members had stood, apparently for years, querying everyone that he didn't already know about a certain doctrinal position that he held, and then refusing them entry into the building if they didn't agree with his view on that topic. You talk about hindering those. Were the Pharisees, you know, unique and new in the history of mankind, or have there always been Pharisees before this bunch? There's always been such, you know, after as well. And so the teaching for Jesus and these Jews, and the extension we find here and elsewhere, you know, in the New Testament, you know, really rings in our ears. A thing to be, you know, so very careful about. And so the scribes and Pharisees refused to enter the kingdom, barred the way to those who were entering in. In verse 14, you have your second woe. This over their theft and hypocrisy. Woe to you, scribes and Pharisees, hypocrites, because you devour widows' houses, even while for a pretense you make long prayers. Therefore, you shall receive greater condemnation. Now, there are degrees of punishment, even as there are degrees of sin. We've talked about that on other occasions as well. It's just one of several places in the New Testament where that's pointed out. There's a greater condemnation coming for these men. And this because the heart was so hardened that they were apparently running widows out of their homes. They just, you know, rather than practicing the pure and undefiled religion for the sake of widows and orphans, you know, utterly bereft of even those most natural of human feelings. Woe to you, scribes and Pharisees. In another single verse, woe, verse 15. Hypocrites, because you travel about on sea and land to make one proselyte. And when he becomes one, you make him twice as much a son of Gehenna as yourselves. Now, brethren, there's been much debate as to whether or not the Jews even believed in, you know, an eternal torment. So the word hell that often, you know, comes to our mind and our way of thinking likely wasn't even a part of the Jewish thinking. But the threat of being defiled as a child-killing idolater, to be defiled in Gehenna, that meant business to these Jews at that time. This is a colossal insult and threat. This was a thing that they'd known throughout their history as among their most titanic failures. To be associated with it, to say, you know, that you're guilty of such things, well, they're going to receive a greater condemnation. And you make people that become your proselytes twice as much sons of Gehenna as you are. Brethren, the sons of Gehenna were the Molech worshipers. This word sons, as we all know so well from our New Testament, means to have those same attitudes or characteristics, but to say you're like your parents. You're just like them. Son of anything. A son of Gehenna, brethren, is a child of Molech, the worst form of idolatry and sin imaginable. You will receive a greater condemnation. You make your disciples twice as much sons of Gehenna as you are. Just wreck everybody that has anything to do with you. You defile them. 16. Woe to you, scribes and Pharisees, hypocrites. Now, this is the longest one, so it runs down through 22. Woe to you, excuse me, I skipped a line. Woe to you blind guides who say, whoever swears by the temple, that is nothing. But whoever swears by the gold of the temple, he is obligated. Whose teaching are we criticizing here? Jesus, of course. Where are we standing? Right there by their treasury where they take up their collections. Here he stands and says, woe to you blind guides who say whoever swears by the temple is nothing, but whoever swears by the gold of the temple is obligated. Can't you just see into these men's minds? What mattered to them? God's temple or the gold that was in it? You swear by that gold, you're going to have to keep that value, Jews. But you can swear by the temple and that won't count. Can you imagine this reversal of God's divine providence and glory to the gold that the physical temple was made out of? meant to be the poorest reflection of His glory, meant to be something far substandard. Even the wisdom of Proverbs is worth more than gold and silver. And you would teach people, your proselytes, sons of Gehenna, that you make them, that the temple is less than the gold? 17. You fools and blind men. I know there's a place that says not supposed to use that word. I'm not going to study that now. I got a whole chapter to finish here. And brethren, the word itself is not wrong. Jesus used it. The circumstances, the attitude, the reasons, they can vary. Warnings are given about how you can pay a price if you use it incorrectly. But Jesus sure enough used it here. You fools, blind men. Which is more important, the gold or the temple that sanctified the gold? And whoever swears by the altar, they also teach, that's nothing. But whoever swears by the offering upon it, he's obligated. Brethren, they're standing there looking at the steps that rose to the Nicanor Gate, which is just unbelievably glorious in Josephus' description, is to be believed. They're there among these four areas where the priests were working and performing their duties. They're there where they're watching over these trumpets, these golden trumpets that are collecting these monies. Whoever swears by the altar is nothing, but whoever swears by the offering on it, he's obligated. You bring the offering to the altar, brethren, which was just out of sight beyond the Nicanor Gate there, in the actual temple courtyard where the actual sacrifices in the altar stood. He's saying, the altar's nothing. The altar is the representation of your sin, of your failure. This is where you bring things to show how wrong you were. And you're saying that whoever swears by that, it's nothing, but whoever swears by the offering on it is obligated? The altar and the offering, which is more important? And again, brethren, they had it upside down. Now you can imagine how hard it would be for the Jews themselves to recognize this or to summon the courage to say so, that their religious leaders were upside down and backwards. They were inside out, too. How wrong can you get? You have valued everything incorrectly. So you, in 19, blind men. Which is more important, the offering or the altar that sanctifies the offering? Here your offering can be accepted and you're forgiven, and you're focusing on the sacrifice itself. 20. He who swears by the altar, third thing these guys were teaching, swears by both the altar and everything on it. He who swears by the temple, Jesus is elaborating, 20. He who swears by the altar, swears by the altar and by everything on it. He who swears by the temple, swears by both the temple and him who dwells within it. And he who swears by heaven, swears by the throne of God and by him who sits upon it. When Jesus gets done here, do you have to keep your vows? You have to keep your vows. And you better learn how to value what you do as opposed to what God does and what is holy and what is not. So, they're breaking those oaths is the whole point. Taking oaths they don't intend to keep, kind of with their fingers, you know, crossed behind their backs. Well, we swore very particularly, you know, by this and not that. So, sorry, but we're not going to do it. Now, 23 and 24 is kind of the heart of this section and also very illuminating. Woe to you, scribes and Pharisees, hypocrites, for you tithe, something we don't do in Christianity at all, mint and dill and cumin, and have neglected the weightier provisions of the law. Justice was taught in the old law. Mercy was taught in the old law. Faithfulness was taught in the old law by the law, not by these guys. They were teaching nothing about those things. as if they didn't even exist in the old law. And here was their most massive error, failing to see the fullness. So that, he says, the last part of 23, these are the things you should have done without neglecting the others. You should have been tithing mint and dill and cumin. I'm glad you were tithing mint and dill and cumin. The law teaches you to tithe mint and dill and cumin. The problem wasn't that they did it. It's that they would obey stuff like that and not justice, not mercy, not faithfulness, neither teach it nor practice it. And so these men were as contrary to Moses' law as ever anybody's ever walked the earth. And we're standing in the temple finding out about it. Imagine the shock for those men. Imagine the shock for these people. You don't cross these guys unless you're the Messiah who says, I know the law. I know what's holy and what's not. I know which sanctifies what. And I'm here to tell you, Pharisees, you're getting none of what Moses taught. So now, we have 24, you blind guides who strain out a gnat and swallow a camel. Oh, brother, there's no two ways to cut it. That's just an insult, isn't it? It is. There's a time and place for such things. He just said an insult that must have stung like just being cracked across the face with somebody's open palm as hard as they knew how. You guys swallowing camels and sitting around straining out gnats because you think it makes you pure. Oof. 25 and 26 is number 6. Woe to you, scribes and Pharisees, hypocrites! You clean the outside of the cup and of the dish, but inside they're full of robbery and self-indulgence. You blind Pharisee, first clean the inside of the cup and of the dish, so that the outside of it may become clean also. Now, brethren, the Pharisees named themselves after the concept of purity. The word Pharisee means to separate. And they used it as their very name with great pride that they had separated themselves from all that was ignorant and defiled, all that was sinful. They were the pure ones. They were the perfect ones. They were the high ones. To say then that you guys are full of robbery and self-indulgence and you're just faking it, and you're not clean, is again a direct swipe at everything a Pharisee stood for. They were named after purity. This is not so. You just the opposite. And now in 27 and 28, woe to you, scribes and Pharisees, hypocrites, for you're like whitewashed tombs, which on the outside appear beautiful. Inside they're full of dead men's bones and all uncleanness. Even so, you too are outwardly appearing righteous to men, but inwardly you're full of hypocrisy and lawlessness. Now, brethren, there's only one law under view. The Pharisees were the keepers of the gates to that law. They barred the way. They wouldn't enter the kingdom themselves. They hindered those that did, made them like idolatrous servants of Molech, killing their children down in that valley, immediately adjacent to the dung gate, after Jesus just said, you're unclean. You're like dead men's bones. You're just whitewashed tombs. Brother, I don't know we've got in our vocabulary or in, you know, our entire culture insults that could be more powerful than what Jesus just hit these Pharisees with. You just can't do it. And of course, he isn't done. There's one more to go. It's the second longest one. Number 8 and 29 through 32. Woe to you, scribes and Pharisees, hypocrites, for you build the tombs of the prophets and adorn the monuments of the righteous, and say if we'd been living in the days of our fathers, we would not have been partners with them in shedding the blood of the prophets. Consequently, you bear witness against yourselves that you are sons of those who murdered the prophets. Now he's insulting their parents. Fill up, then, the measure of the guilt of your fathers. Now, brethren, that's just the judge's gavel. Oh, bam. You're guilty. Guilty as charged. Guilty of everything I've charged you with. Guilty of I didn't even count how many things that Jesus accuses them of. I can't get my tongue in line here. You know, starting there in verse 2. And so, brethren, this is the hammer coming down. And it is, in point of fact, just their last chance. This is the last great speech of Jesus before the cross. This will be, you know, a paramount presentation, which no doubt will have the most hardening impact on the hearts of a group of men who are already wanting to kill him, already conspiring to kill him. So here we have it in 8 woes. You're hypocrites, you're liars and thieves, you value everything wrong, you're not in the kingdom, you'll never get in the kingdom, and you are hindering those who would. Then what follows is the actual sentence. Here's what's coming for you. In 33 through 36, you serpents, you brood of vipers, how shall you escape the sentence of Gehenna? Just to say, that's where you're going. We'll talk about filth, and you're headed right to Molech's feet. Therefore, behold, there's a judgment you cannot escape, a punishment you cannot escape. It is the sentence of Gehenna. Therefore, behold, I am sending you prophets and wise men and scribes. Some of them you will kill and crucify. Some of them you will scourge in your synagogues and persecute from city to city, that upon you may fall all the righteous blood shed on earth from, here's the bracket, the blood of righteous Abel to the blood of Zechariah, the son of Berechiah, whom you murdered between the temple and the altar. Now, we don't know who this is, and it's not the prophet Zechariah. They'd murdered him. It was a recent murder. We do not know who he was. But they killed him inside the Nicanor gate. He has to have been some kind of a priest. You guys have murdered this man between the temple and the altar. Truly, I say to you, all these things shall come upon this generation. Now, brethren, they knew that they were alive and that they were in the generation Jesus was talking to. And so far as I know, I don't think there is one exception in the history of Bible study, but that everybody agrees, verse 36 says that we're talking about those people living then, and those people living then will experience the sentence of Gehenna. They're going there. Now, lastly, here we'll close. You have verses 37 through 39 where the place as well as the time for that generation's destruction is stipulated. O Jerusalem, Jerusalem, who kills the prophets, stones those who are sent to her. How often I wanted to gather your children together the way a hen gathers her chicks under her wings. You were unwilling. Behold, your house is being left to you desolate. Brethren, when those words are uttered, where is Jesus? He's standing in the house. He's standing in the temple courtyards. Not a priest. He's not allowed to go into the courtyard there. But he is talking to people at this very location. I have to wonder about these Pharisees, since Pharisees are not priests. And he charges them with the murder of a guy that they can't get to because he died, in where only the priest can go. My suspicion here, brethren, is you get the same answer there to this question. Who killed Jesus? And universally in your New Testament, it's the Jews, not the Romans. The Romans wielded the hammers. But who killed Jesus? Who forced Pilate? Who made it happen? Who's guilty for the death of Jesus? These men, chapter 23, is full of. Your house is left to you desolate. It's going to take place in that generation, according to verse 36. And Jesus closes this chapter as it's designated. I say to you, from now on, you shall not see me until you say, blessed is he who comes in the name of the Lord. Now, Jesus knows he's going to die. The Pharisees, I suspect, though, in the use of this term see right here, he means more than just the fact that, he's going to die, but that they won't see in the sense of understanding or appreciating that he's the Son of the living God. Now, you can wrestle with that. That 39th verse is kind of a problem there, but, which of the two ideas is in view or most in view or maybe exclusively in view. But here is chapter 23, brethren. Chapter 23 establishes the foundation and the topic that the question will be asked by questions by the apostles will be asked in the next chapter. Please be reading Matthew 24, particularly those of you that haven't been here recently, and watch what happens now as next week we'll take up 24. What does chapter 23 mean to us? We're not Pharisees, never seen the temple, never going to, not guilty of any of this hypocrisy. Why does Jesus bother to spend a whole chapter and the Holy Spirit then to record it for us? None of this directly impacts us. It's not a prophecy about us. Why is it here? Because it was fulfilled in Jerusalem and in that generation that those men were killed, precisely as Jesus said, for their defilement. And Roman history, to be the judge of it, tossed into Gehenna. This is where, in fact, the entire Temple Mount is tossed. The whole thing's going to be scraped barren 40 years later because these people would not accept their Messiah. And that religion then will die with them, never to be practiced again. The warning stands for us as well. God will judge you. God will judge you fairly, impartially, very particularly and personally. There is an all-seeing eye watching you. So we learn, stand back from sin of every kind. We learn that Jesus is the Christ, the Son of the living God, a prophet who can predict the future and make it happen. We learn to be faithful servants of an all-powerful God who deserves, out of both fear and love, our complete surrender to the King. He is our Lord. Let us serve Him like we mean it, like we understand it. As always, we offer the invitation. If you're not yet a Christian, wish to become one this morning. If you are a Christian, feel the need for prayer, for Bible study, for help of any kind, come please speak with me as we